It's Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The Charlotte Mecklenburg Public Library's annual Novella Festival is underway, and we come to you at this hour from Ovens Auditorium for a conversation with two-time novelist Khaled Hosseini. His work has been described by critics as astounding, stunning, poignant, powerful, and extraordinary. Both of his novels, The Kite Runner and A Thousand Splendid Suns, spend time in Hosseini's native Afghanistan and provide readers an understanding of the country, its people, and their way of life that would be difficult for most outsiders to obtain without the insights provided in these compelling volumes. The Kite Runner is about friendship, betrayal, and the price of both. A Thousand Splendid Suns revolves around the intersecting lives of two Afghan women at a time of Taliban control. Interwoven into both are the delicate threads of religion, class, power, and sect. Khaled Hosseini was born in Kabul in 1965. His father was a diplomat in the Afghan Foreign Ministry, his mother a high school teacher. The Soviets invaded Afghanistan while Hosseini's father was posted to Paris, and so in 1980, his family was granted political asylum in the United States and settled in San Jose, California. 4 years later, he graduated from high school there, went on to graduate from Santa Clara University, and earned a medical degree at the University of California, San Diego School of Medicine. During his 8 years of medical practice, he began writing The Kite Runner. His first novel became an international bestseller, published in 48 countries, and was made into a movie. His second work, A Thousand Splendid Suns, was published in May 2007 and is in print in 25 countries. We are delighted to have Khaled Hosseini with us for the hour. Nothing like an intimate conversation between two people and several thousand of his closest friends. Welcome to Charlotte. You just got off the airplane, I'm told, right?
Last night.
And you flew in with another author who will be at the Novella Festival, Armistead Maupin.
Yeah, I sat for 4.5 hours next to Armistead Maupin without knowing that was him. And then we were introduced at the baggage claim.
So he wasn't reading your book and you weren't reading his, right?
No. Maybe if this was a movie, what would be.
But that does happen to you.
We'd be meeting cute, you know.
That did happen to you. You've done that a lot. You've been on airplanes and watched people read your book.
It happens now and then, yeah. I've actually sat next to people who were reading my book. And it's always a moment of, should I say something? I've never had the guts to come out and say, you know, I wrote this. Because then it's just going to be weird.
When most Americans think about Afghanistan or see Afghanistan on TV, on the news, we think of war, we think of deprivation, we think of squalid conditions in a place that looks like time hasn't changed since the Middle Ages. That was not your childhood experience in Kabul. And I'm sure that the people of Afghanistan also see their homeland quite differently from the way that we see it. Is that partly why you wanted to write these books, to give us the real Afghanistan?
You know, it became that. For me, writing is always about discovering something about characters, about following a story and seeing where it goes. But as I was writing these books, I realized that I'm not just telling a story, but I'm also in some way illuminating something about this country, which, as you said, has become synonymous with bin Laden, the Taliban, and war. And for a lot of people, Afghanistan is caves and mountains. And the fact is that it's actually a strikingly beautiful country. I was at a book engagement one time, and this lady walked up to me. She goes, "I read your book. I had no idea there were trees in Afghanistan." Because, you know, the images that you see on television is you know, the Tora Bora and then the mountains and the caves, and that's all you see. But in fact, it's a gorgeous country. In the north of the country, there are valleys and rivers, and it's actually quite lush. And also, you know, when I grew up in Afghanistan, Kabul was a very up-and-coming cosmopolitan city. I mean, it had a cultural life, had an intellectual life, it had a, you know, an artistic life, and it's so at odds with the image that most people, perhaps rightfully, have of Afghanistan.
I was surprised, actually, when I was reading The Kite Runner, that there would be a car in the driveway of Baba's house.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that's not unusual, or it wasn't unusual in that time. You have said, "I never sat down to write with broad, sweeping ideas in mind, and certainly never with a specific agenda. It's quite a burden for a writer to feel a responsibility to represent his or her own culture and to educate others about it." And yet, that is exactly what you have achieved through these two books.
It's not what I set out to do. I wrote The Kite Runner as a short story after I saw a news report on television about the Taliban having banned kite flying back in the spring of 1999. And I thought I was just going to write a story about kind of this nostalgic story about two boys who are flying kites in Kabul, and ended up becoming something altogether different. It became a story about guilt and about loss, about friendship, about brotherhood, and also about loss of homeland and war and being uprooted and displaced. And it became about the difference between people who stayed behind and those who went into exile and what it's like to return home after war. It became bigger and bigger. So it started with a small seed and it just kind of grew. But that wasn't the intent initially.
Well, for people who don't write, that's sometimes very surprising that an author will sit down and write and not know where it's going. And it becomes a revelation to him or her while they're sitting at the keyboard or writing it out longhand, and it reveals itself to them. Is that how it feels to you?
Yeah, it's the best thing about writing, in fact. That usually if I know where I'm going, I become bored quickly with it. And I just want to get to the point and get to where I'm going. And it just never works for me.
So when you wrote The Kite Runner as a short story, how many characters were in it that made it to the book? How many characters came as a result of being in the book but not being in the short story?
The skeleton frame of the novel was in the short story. In the short story, I don't want to spoil anything, but in the short story, the main character goes to Pakistan. And he learns the fate of his childhood friend from this friend of his father's.
Rahim Khan.
Yeah, and he just comes home, and the story ended there. So I kind of knew that the book was going to get up to that point. What happened after that, I had no clue, but I knew that it couldn't end with that. It was very anticlimactic, and really, ultimately, what was most unsatisfying about the short story. But I rarely know where I'm going. I rarely know what's going to happen. I had no idea writing the novel about the real nature of the relationship between the boys. I had no idea that he was going to go back to Afghanistan or what he would find when he goes there or why even he was going. And it is just a process of discovering as I was going along. And that's the thing I love about fiction is the inherent surprises in telling the story.
How often do you write yourself into a corner?
All the time. All the time, but I've accepted it as part of what it takes to write a first draft. I have to do that. I have to go into all sorts of blind alleys and just kind of fumble my way out, and eventually something will happen. And if nothing happens, then, you know, it's kind of, to me, to use a medical terminology, is a symptomatic of some kind of underlying problem with the story.
Well, you said that to another interviewer that writing is often a matter of sitting in front of the computer and worrying. It's what writing comes down to, you said, worrying that things aren't going to work out. And yet you've also described yourself as an optimist. Which is it?
Well, no, it's both. It is about writing, about sitting in front of a computer, often in questionable states of hygiene, I should say. And
it's kind of like being on the radio. We're not wearing any pants.
You know, and worrying that it's not going to happen. That's the nature. I think there's an inherent insecurity which is, I think, very healthy. Now, it can't be crippling. I always have faith that in the end something is going to happen and that I'm going to work my way out of it. But you don't carry anything over. After you wrote your first novel, no matter how successful, you don't carry that confidence over into the second book, because you sit and you're back at square one. You're back in some part of you whispering that you're a hack, that you got lucky, that, you know, everything you ever felt, you ever knew, ever experienced, had any insight about in your own limited way, that you've already put it out there. There's nothing in the tank. And it's nice to discover that that's not the case.
But now you've had success with two novels, A Thousand Splendid Suns being the second, and you're working on your third at the moment, so...
I'm worrying over the third.
Well, but now you got two, so you can't be a hack.
No,
there's nothing to worry about now.
I could
be
on book 25, and it's not going to change. You need that, because when you become confident, and this is a... I hear athletes say this all the time, and to some degree it's true about writing. When you become real confident, you lose your edge, you lose your... I want to be unsatisfied with what I'm doing, and I want to not think that I'm there.
You wrote the short story, I believe, The Kite Runner, wrote just prior to the 9/11 attacks, is that correct?
Oh, that was written over 2 years before 9/11.
And then there was some question in your mind, I understand this could be wrong, about whether or not this would be something that could be turned into a book that would be accepted and read by the American people because of the 9/11 attacks?
No, I actually began the process of... I started in March of 2001, expanding that short story into a book. And when September 11th happened, I was a good two-thirds of the way through. At that point, I felt like the manuscript was done. I mean, I lost all will to continue, partly because, like everybody else, I was just swept up in the enormity of what was going on, with the added dimension that Afghanistan suddenly was front and center, and all these things were happening in a country where I was raised. But also partly because I felt there was something distasteful, maybe, about this great tragedy's happened and 3,000 people died and we're going to go to war, and then here I come through the back door with a novel ready and set to go about this country that we're about to... It just felt to me there was something... opportunistic about it. And it was really my wife who talked me out of that line of thought. And, and she's an attorney, I should say. And we have lawyers in the audience. And she was a rhetoric major, a debate major in school. So I never stood a chance. And she argued that I ought to finish the book and turn it in because... or what you said earlier, all people knew about Afghanistan was the Taliban. And she said, this book can show people a different face of that country.
And it spread by word of mouth. The public library here said that based on the number of books checked out, that you have been one of the most consistently popular authors since The Kite Runner was released. And while The Kite Runner came out with great reviews, their experience has been that it's really been tremendous word of mouth promotion that has kept your work among the top requested checked out books here. And the same thing is happening to A Thousand Splendid Suns. So there must be an appetite for this information, this knowledge, in Charlotte and around the country. I want to come back and get an answer to that in a second, but we have to take a break, so we'll do that right now. Our guest is Khaled Hosseini, the author of A Thousand Splendid Suns and The Kite Runner.
Charlotte Talks made possible in part today by Hendrick Acura in Charlotte, introducing the redesigned 2009 Acura TSX and TL sedans featuring standard Bluetooth wireless telephone and MP3 integration. Virtual showroom at HendrickAcura.com. And the Charlotte Business Journal's Power Breakfast 2, Wachovia CEO Bob Steele discusses how Wells Fargo's acquisition affects Charlotte. November 20th, 7:30 a.m., Charlotte Convention Center. Tickets at CharlotteBusinessJournal.com/events. Coming up Monday on Charlotte Talks, Tom Wopat joins Mike Collins in our Spirit Square studio. You might remember Tom Wopat as Luke Duke from the late 70s, early 80s hit TV show The Dukes of Hazzard. But Tom Wopat has moved on to music in more recent years. He's now got two Tony nominations to his credit, and he comes to town in November to play Billy Flynn in a touring production of Chicago. But first he'll join us to talk about his musical roots and life after Hazzard County. It's Monday at 9, here on your NPR News Source, 90.7 FM, WFAE.
The Friday News Roundup. The declining economy leads to more job cuts and increased worry on Wall Street. The administration considers a $40 billion package to help homeowners on the brink of foreclosure. And John McCain and Barack Obama spar over their economic plans. The Diane Rehm Show, Friday.
This morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 FM, WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, Khaled Hosseini, and we're coming to you from Ovens Auditorium as part of the Novello Festival of Reading for the Public Library. We have 2,100 people here in the audience. Let yourself be heard. You have also drawn the largest crowd of any author in the history of Novello. We found out just before this. So that being one of the most consistently checked out authors at the library here and the word of mouth that has made both of your books a sensation around the country, how do you explain that phenomenon? Is it just that we hunger to know about that part of the world, or that your books bring us a human side of that part of the world?
It's when something reaches this kind of level of popularity, there's always some elusive quality about it that is hard to pinpoint. But I think that's part of it. Although for me, I get a lot of emails from people who say, you know, I've kind of postponed reading this book because it was like about Afghanistan, and it sounded like it was going to be depressing, and it sounded like the kind of thing I should read, but I kind of didn't want to. But you know, I think people respond to the characters. I think people respond to the central character who's flawed, I think, in very human ways, who is troubled. And I think he's flawed in ways that you and I are, and that everybody in this audience is, in that he's capable of some very heroic things and also capable of some really terrible things. And I think we all have that ability. And I think in the process of them reading this book, there's an interest that develops in Afghanistan and hopefully an insight about the country. When the book came out, I was convinced that my cousins were going to read it, and my family, and maybe a few people who were interested in Afghanistan, and that would be really it. But you know, I really owe a debt to a public libraries, because they embraced the book very early on. And they would literally just put it in the hands of the people who were coming to the library. And I think that part of the word of mouth, you know, a lot of it is due to libraries. And also independent bookstores who picked the book up early, championed it, and put it in the hands of people.
I didn't know there were that many independent bookstore owners.
Yeah, I know.
They're all here tonight. Excellent. Because of what I do, I have the opportunity to talk to people like you who are remarkable individuals, and I'm always curious when something like this happens. You sit down as a doctor in your spare time, and you write a book, and the book becomes an international bestseller, and they turn it into a movie, and you sit down and you write your second book, and it becomes a bestseller. This has changed your life in fundamental ways. What's the difference? How is your life different? Is it better? Is it worse? Are you doing things now that you could never have done if you were a doctor? Do you still practice medicine? Do you miss the practice of medicine?
My life is fundamentally changed and fundamentally better. I'm one of these small minority of people in the world who get to do the thing that has been their lifelong childhood passion since the time that they can, from the earliest memory, and they get to do it as a livelihood, and they get rewarded for it, and they get to hear from people. It's the blessing, the enormity of it is incomprehensible to me. So I feel very lucky. My life has changed. I mean, I went to medicine for very rational reasons. My family was struggling financially, and I never considered that I could ever become a writer. I mean, that thought never really materialized in a real way. I always felt like writers were existed in another stratosphere, in another dimension, and then we were here. And so I went to medicine for that, but I quit medicine about 4 years ago. I kept working for a year and a half after The Kite Runner was published, and I ended up quitting because when I was seeing patients, we were spending 13 minutes of my 15 minutes signing books and answering, talking about, you know, Amir and Hassan and this and that. And then we would get the last 2 minutes of the stroke that they had 2 weeks ago. So I realized that, you know, I may not be doing these people a lot of good, but I better duck out. So, you know, I quit.
How much of The Kite Runner is autobiographical? Because Amir wants to be a writer, and he starts writing short stories at a very young age, and then goes on to do it, despite the fact that he, once they came to America, he and Baba lived in very difficult conditions. How much of it is you?
Quite a bit, although not the storyline itself and what the falling out between the friends and so on, but certainly my life was a lot like his in the sense that I lived in Kabul in the same era. I belonged to the same socioeconomic section of that society. I began writing short stories like he did at a very, very young age. I loved Westerns growing up, and I loved movies growing up. Flew kites a lot with my brother and my cousins, and that was in fact maybe the central image for me of my childhood are those kites. When I think of Kabul 1970s, immediately I think of the kites, and the kites came before the story even when I was writing this book. And then the middle section of the book resembles my life a lot. I came with my father and my family to the States, and I remember my dad and I would go to the flea market with his van. We would sell this junk that we had bought at garage sales for a small profit. And while we were there, we would meet these Afghans who were doing the same thing. And they used to work at the foreign ministry with my dad. And one of them was a college professor. One of them was a lawyer. And there they were, you know, selling tennis rackets and sewing machines. And so that flea market scene became the nucleus of the immigrant section of the book. And that section of it is quite a lot like my life.
Amir gets out with Baba and they come to America, and others stay behind or go into Pakistan and don't quite, they suffer. You got out. Your family got out. Is there any guilt associated with that? I mean, do you think about why me? Why did our family get out? Why are there so many who were left behind, who suffered through the Taliban, who suffered through the wars that preceded and followed them?
Oh, all the time. All the time. There's a lot of pages of this novel are dripping with a sense of guilt. And I felt it very, very acutely the first time I went to Afghanistan. And I got to see for myself the people who got stayed behind and what happened to them and how they were living. And it's one thing to see it on television and the newspaper. When you actually walk the streets and see these people who've been scarred both physically and emotionally, and you see all the orphans and you see all the widows that are, you know, trying to take care of 5, 6, 7 children, and you see the devastation that these people have suffered, and you do ask yourself, you know, why have I done good with what I was given and so on, and I think eventually you have to use that. You know, there's two kinds of guilt. There's the kind that is internalized and gnaws at you, and is a very kind of destructive thing. And then there's the kind where you can just kind of turn it around, externalize it, and use it as a tool to do something about that which caused the guilt in the first place.
There's a scene in The Kite Runner where Amir comes back to Afghanistan as an adult to try to find his nephew. And he's being driven there by a driver, and the driver doesn't think very highly of him at the time. And the driver points to an old man along the side of the road, walking down the road in ragged clothes, and says, "That's the Afghanistan I know. You've always been a tourist here. You just didn't know it."
Right.
That's you talking, isn't it? I mean,
that's definitely me talking. Look, Afghanistan, Kabul, especially, you know, the coterie of friends that my family and I had that crust of the society was not representative of most of Afghanistan. Afghanistan is not a nation of urbanized middle-class people. I mean, it's largely a rural country. 90% of the people live in the countryside, and it's one of the poorest nations in the world. So in a sense, even when I was living in Afghanistan, I was aware that I'm living in kind of an island, really, where I was sheltered to some extent from the harshest realities of living in Afghanistan. This is even before the Soviet war in the so-called good old days. To go back now and see the destruction, I mean, there's definitely a sense of what is it called, survivor's guilt. You definitely feel that.
We also see a country in your book, and when we hear about it on the news, of people that cling to traditions and preconceptions that sometimes act against them. Is that something that's particular to Afghanistan and to the Middle East, or is that something that you see all over the world, that we are locked into our own box by our own preconceptions and our own traditions?
I think to a certain extent we are. I mean, certainly it's something that I have noticed in the in the immigrant community, in the older generation. For the classic example of that, what you're saying in the Kite Runner, is the general. Mm-hmm. Who's this guy who was a very successful general in Afghanistan, and now he's kind of reduced to a shadow of his former self, but every day he wakes up and he wears the suit and he has the watch and he keeps waiting for Afghanistan to become free so he can go back and live out the glory days again. And I have met my share of generals in the Afghan community, people who have those ideas of the old world and just simply haven't been able to move on. But I see much less of it in the younger, subsequent generations.
Why did you want to be a writer? When did that happen for you?
When did I want to be a writer?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's two different questions. I never decided that I was going to write. I think writers are born and they're hardwired. I've never met, in the last 5-6 years that I've been doing this, I've yet to meet a writer who made a conscious decision to write. I can't remember a time in my life where it wasn't the thing that I wanted to do the most. Even when I was a kid, from the time that I could pick up a pen, I was creating stories. I distinctly remember writing these little plays that I would force my siblings and my cousins to act in, and we would stage them at parties for our families. So the drive to create was always there. Now, becoming a writer is a different question. To actually pursue it as a profession is an entirely different question. And I never did. I never thought that I had the writing chops. I never felt that I would get to that stratosphere where published writers live. That's a different matter altogether. And I really fell into it by accident. It's not like I pursued this.
Were you a reader as a child?
Yeah.
What did you read?
Well, as a kid, growing up in Afghanistan, I read both Farsi literature, and both of my parents were very articulate people who were very literate, who were raised around the tradition of Afghan and Persian poetry. So I was raised around Rumi and Hafez and Sa'di and Omar Khayyam and people like that. But I also discovered my love for novels from a very young age. And there was a bookstore in Kabul, sold used books, where you could buy these paperbacks, and they had these Farsi translations of novels that were written in Europe and in the U.S. And to say that it was eclectic would be understating it, but you would find Don Quixote next to Mike Hammer, Ian Fleming or somebody like that. So I kind of read whatever I could get my hands on, but I remember reading 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and they had these young adult condensed versions of classics. So I read the condensed version of Moby Dick and Alice in Wonderland. They were all in Farsi. And that's when I really discovered my love for novels. The first novel read...
What is the first line of Moby Dick in Farsi?
Name my Ismailist. The first novel that I read in its entirety, actually, was The Exorcist. And I was 10 years old. It was serialized in this women's magazine. And I would bike and buy the issue and then duck out and read it. And my folks had no idea. So I read it. That was the first book that I read entirely. The other ones were like these condensed books.
We have two microphones in the house that we've asked people to use if they want to ask questions. And we've also been passing out little slips of paper that people can write down questions on. And I'll share with you a couple of the questions we have from people in our audience. What Middle Eastern or Afghan writer should we read besides you?
Well, I mean, and I'll stick to Afghanistan. I think we're going to see in the next few years a lot of up-and-coming Afghan authors. The writers in Afghanistan are at a distinct disadvantage in that the logistics to pursue their dreams and to be published and celebrated the way I've been just don't exist because of a lack of a real functioning printing press and a lack of inability to market things and so on and so forth. In the diaspora community, we have promising young writers, and we have some writers who've published books. But some books that have been written by Afghans that I would recommend, one is called East of Kabul, West of New York. It was written by an Afghan-American, a friend of mine named Tamim Ansari, who writes very beautifully, very eloquently about the bicultural experience and being kind of straddling two cultures. There's also other books, one called The Storyteller's Daughter, and a lot of them are memoirs and kind of testimonies and eyewitness accounts of what happened to Afghanistan the last 20 years. And to me, they're invaluable because we're hearing from people who lived through the upheavals of Afghanistan and who lived to tell the story.
Another Melissa wants to know, have you received any backlash from either your family or from fellow Afghanis about after both books became national bestsellers?
No, I the backlash that I've received has been from largely from fellow Afghans that fell. There's nobody feels indifferent about my books in the Afghan community, it seems like. They fall into two camps. One camp feels very favorably, and they feel that the book, you know, represents them well, that it illuminates things about Afghanistan, that these books have given Afghanistan a human dimension. And there's even a sense of nationalistic pride about it because there's an issue of self-esteem, you know, that finally we can say the word Afghanistan and mention something other than the Taliban and bin Laden. And they take pride in that. But there's another camp that feels, particularly the first book, The Kite Runner, deals with issues that in Afghanistan are very difficult and are sensitive and in many ways taboo. The whole issue of talking about ethnic rivalry is, you know, if you were at a cocktail party in Kabul and you began having this kind of talk, it would be considered impolite.
Let me take a break because we have to, and we'll come right back at Ovens Auditorium with Khalid Hosseini on WFAE.
Our programming on Charlotte Talks on WFAE, funded by Charlotte Eye, Ear, Nose, and Throat Associates, welcoming Dr. Teresa Gillig. Dr. Gillig specializes in all areas of pediatric ophthalmology and adult strabismus. Details at goodsenses.com. And by the Charlotte Symphony, Terry Fisher conducts Berlioz Symphony Fantastique and Fauré's Requiem with the Oratorio Singers, October 31st and November 1st at Blumenthal Performing Arts Center. Tickets at charlottesymphony.org. Coming up next at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, it's the Friday News Roundup. Among the topics they'll discuss today, the declining economy leads to more job cuts and increased worry on Wall Street, and the administration considers a $40 billion package to help homeowners on the brink of foreclosure. Also, John McCain and Barack Obama spar over their economic plans. Those topics all coming up in about 20 minutes on the News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show, here on Listener Funded, 90.7 FM, WFAE. More of our interview with Khalid Hosseini coming up next.
Hi, I'm Kai Riznall, the host of Marketplace, saying congratulations on becoming an investor. Nope, not talking about 401ks or the hottest Wall Street stock. If you made a financial contribution to this public radio station during its recent pledge drive, you can plan for great returns on your investments. Whether it's our coverage of breaking news or fresh insights from Marketplace commentators, we couldn't do it without you. So thanks for investing in Marketplace and this public radio station.
We're back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. We're at Ovens Auditorium with Khaled Hosseini, the author of The Kite Runner and A Thousand Splendid Suns. And we're going to open our microphones up in the aisles here for the assembled multitude to ask some questions as well. Let's begin over here. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Hosseini, it is such an honor to be here to hear you speak. To say I loved your books would be an understatement. But my question is, with A Thousand Splendid Suns, you did such an amazing job of writing from a woman's point of view. And being a married woman of 13 years, I would like to know, how in the world did you do that? And can you give some tips that I might be able to give to my husband?
Well, that was, you know, when I wrote The Kite Runner, I wrote it in really a year, and I was working full-time as a doctor. I wrote A Thousand Splendid Suns largely when I was had already quit medicine, and it took me almost 3 years. And the reason for that is largely because that was the struggle. I became obsessed with the idea that I wanted to represent the female perspective correctly, And I didn't want my male masculine voice to be on the pages and to have the reader have that kind of incongruous experience of seeing that this is a man struggling very hard to sound like a woman. And it became, the pursuit of it almost crippled me in terms of writing this book. I couldn't trust anything that I was writing, and everything that I would write would disgust me. And eventually I almost gave up until I reached the solution, and the solution, every solution I've ever found in writing has been incredibly simple, but I have to go down those blind alleys that we were speaking about earlier and fumble my way to the solution. And the solution for me ultimately was to just not worry about it and to just ignore it and to write Maryam and Layla as people. And for those who haven't read the book, I won't spoil anything, but just to get a little specific, why does Maryam go to her father's house? And, you know, why does she cling to this baby? And in the end, why does she do what she ends up doing? And why does, what does Layla see in Maryam that's lacking in her own life? So it became about finding what the core, the essence, the fundamental drives of these characters were, regardless of gender. And once I made that connection, suddenly a very magical thing happened. I saw that my voice was fading from the pages, and these women were talking for themselves. And at least to my perception of it, it was starting to feel authentic. And it was a tremendous reward for me to have readers, especially women, write to me and say what you said. So I really appreciate it. Thank you.
So you said at one time that in early drafts of the book, it felt as though you were the ventriloquist and they were your dummies.
Yeah.
Until they found their own voice, and it was a watershed moment. But it didn't just happen like that. It was a gradual thing over time?
It's always gradual over time. You always have to put in the work and eventually end up there. You have to earn it. I'm sure there are the truly great writers see it right away, and they have a shortcut in their brain. They can get there right away. But for the rest of us, we kind of have to find our way there. But when it happens, it's very, very special. It was the highlight of writing this manuscript for me.
Let's go over here. Welcome.
Hi, my name is Julie. Loved both of the books. And as a first-generation American, my parents immigrated from the Middle East, I really identified with what I felt was your portrayal of your view of Afghanistan. And I was just curious as to what your hope for Afghanistan is, and were you trying to take on some of those stereotypes that that people have that aren't really true about your country?
My hopes for the future of Afghanistan are very sober. I went there in 2003, and I think it would be accurate to say that I came back a lot more hopeful and optimistic than I did this last time. I think the situation there has changed, some ways for the better, but I think largely for the worse. And we're in the middle of an election season, and you're hearing both candidates talking about that and saying that we took our eye off the ball in Afghanistan, and now we're paying the price for it. And there's a lot of truth in that, I think. Now Afghanistan is a country where there is a very stout and violent insurgency in the south and the east. It's a country where narcotics now account for 50% of the GDP of the economy. It's a country where there's still rampant poverty and homelessness and joblessness, where women's rights hasn't yet been addressed satisfactorily. So there's a lot of problems. The thing that gives me hope is that there was a survey done in 32 provinces in Afghanistan last year. 15,000 people were asked whether they felt optimistic about their future. And 80% of the people said they did. And I would think that if we did that survey in this country, we would get a very different result. So there's an inherent optimism in the Afghan people, who are very resilient, very industrious, very eager, ready and willing to rebuild their country. But I think as an international community, to some extent, we have failed them. And I think it would be a real tragedy if we don't address these problems.
There's also, as I understand it, a growing sentiment, rightfully or not, that promises made by America in Afghanistan are not being kept. Is that true? Have you found that to be true?
I think that's fair to say. If you poll people in Afghanistan, and repeatedly polls have shown that there's overwhelmingly that the presence of the West is seen as a favorable thing, as a positive thing. Not because people have a love for the presence of foreign troops there. In fact, quite the opposite. They're very, very sovereign and independent people. But I think they understand that the alternative to the presence of NATO, U.S., is a return to the days of warlordism, extremism, and Afghanistan being a hotbed for terrorists. And that's just something that people don't want to go back to. But there is, I think, a sense of growing disillusion, which I find to be a very, very dangerous thing. The Afghan people, by and large, appreciate the individual freedom that they have now, which they didn't have under the Taliban. But by and large, they don't see a noticeable difference in the quality of their life. They still don't have jobs. They're still, half the country lives on less than a dollar a day. Almost half the country has no access to clean water, and so on. And that's compounded, I think, especially in the last year, by a series of really catastrophic military strikes by NATO and the U.S., which has taken thousands of civilian lives, unfortunately. And so there's, I think, a trend towards, you know, resentment for the presence. And what we have to prove to the people is that it's not just about bombs and airstrikes, but we will also help rebuild the civil sector, which is where we've really failed.
I want to come back to the Taliban if time permits, but let's go over here to this young woman who's been standing here for 20 minutes.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. My
question really is about setting, because I probably speak for a lot of people here who knew nothing about Afghanistan and who were brought from their, you know, living rooms into these environments that they'd never had any opportunity to learn about. Had you been back to Afghanistan on multiple occasions, or is that memory created from only your past? How did you create that setting so that we were all able to join the women in their home and join, you know, Amir as he ran down the street?
Well, the sections that are pre-Soviet war are largely from my memories, which were very vivid to my own surprise. And I was transported immediately back to where it was like to be a kid in the 70s in Kabul. So I found that part of it quite easy. But the challenging parts were writing about the sections when they're living through the Taliban eras. And that was more difficult. But I went to Afghanistan in 2003, not at all for purposes of research, but really just to reconnect and see the country for myself. And I spoke to myriad people. I spoke to doormen and taxi drivers and policemen and women who worked in schools and hospitals in non-governmental organizations. And the Afghan people are very generous with their stories. They're very willing to sit down with you and just tell you, you know, what life was like for them during the Civil War, when the Taliban were there, when the Soviets were there. So I walked away with a sense of not just an academic understanding of what happened, but a a personal understanding with a human dimension, and walked away with a wealth of details and anecdotes which were imprinted on my mind. An example being a neurosurgeon told me that when during the Civil War there'd be so many people flooding the waiting room in his OR, in the emergency room, and the hospital was so under-equipped that he would frequently have to perform amputations, cesarean sections without anesthesia. And it's the kind of detail that is impossible to forget. So when I sat down to write the book, a year and a half later, suddenly I found that all those voices came back, and the collective experience of those people really inspired this book.
Let's go over here. Welcome.
Hi, my name's Hannah. So my teacher made either one of your books required reading for us last year, and I know that which wasn't a problem. And and I know that when a lot of my classmates and I chose to read A Thousand Splendid Suns, one of the most striking parts for us was that the depiction of women and their restrictions placed on them by the Taliban. How much of that is based on personal experiences from your childhood?
From my family?
Or your childhood, whichever one.
Or my travels. Yeah, I mean, the challenge for me was what the Taliban did in Afghanistan by the time I wrote this book had been pretty well documented. And the challenge for me was to try to address it in such a way that it wouldn't feel cliched. But going to Afghanistan in 2003 and speaking to women, I walked away with a real kind of personal understanding of just how much the women of Afghanistan suffered. Possibly, other than children, no other group was made to endure what the women endured. Especially after the Soviets left, women were sold into prostitution rings. They were forced into marriage. They suffered from gender-based abuse like rape and so on. And unfortunately, things for women today have improved to a certain extent, but I think they've improved in urban pockets. In Kabul, for instance, there's women speaking on television and women who are in the parliament, and there's even a provincial governor in Bamiyan who's a woman, and slowly things are changing. But as I said earlier, Afghanistan is a rural country, and in much of the countryside is a very patriarchal society living by tribal rules and traditions and customs, and there women have been absent from public life forever, long before the Taliban were even, you know, a movement. And that's where I think the real challenge is, how to give voice to women in regions in Afghanistan where traditionally they've been voiceless and faceless and absent in a meaningful way from public life.
To those of us in the West, the Taliban appear to be sociopaths. I mean, where does their philosophy come from, and how did it blossom, and how did it take root, and why was it so easy? It's apparently easy for them to come in and subjugate those people for as long as they did.
Well, you have to remember that the environment in which the Taliban took Afghanistan was very conducive to their success. In the mid-1990s, Afghanistan suffered through a very, very brutal war between different warlord factions who up to that point had been fighting the Soviets. When the Soviets left, these guys were left behind, armed to the teeth, each with their own private militia, each with designs of their own, and each with the deep-seated contempt for other groups because of ethnic differences. And so what happened was that these factions fought each other violently for 4 years, killed 50,000 civilians in Kabul alone, destroyed over 70% of Kabul in the process. It was a period of looting, of rape, of killing, of snipers taking shot at civilians, of rockets landing all day. And there's a line in The Kite Runner, and rather in A Thousand Splendid Suns, where Lila says there were so many rockets flying and exploding at night that you could read a newspaper in the light of it. And that's a direct line that this man told me about the degree of the fighting in Kabul. People were sick of it. They just wanted to go to the store, buy a bottle of milk, and not have to risk their lives in the process. What the Taliban brought was peace. That's undeniable. They brought stability. Kabul became very safe. You could walk at any time and not be worried that you were going to be mugged or you're going to be shot. Of course, that peace came at a very steep price, because they brought with them that very, very, very hard, unforgiving, patriarchal custom.
Okay, let's go back over here.
I have a question about language. English isn't the language you were born to, although you speak and write as if it were. So when you talk about the voices coming to you in your books, do they come to you in Farsi or in English? Are you translating what you hear? And does the story fundamentally change because you tell it in English and not Farsi? And I'm wondering if there's a political dimension to this as well as an aesthetic one.
I speak Farsi at home. It's my native tongue. But I think when I'm writing my books, I think in English. I do my multiplication table still in Farsi in my head. That hasn't changed. But when I'm writing, for me, English has become such a natural language. I lack the rhythm and the cadence and the flow of prose in Farsi. I can write and read Farsi. I can write an essay in Farsi, but I can't write fiction. I just don't have that voice in me.
Are you happy with the movie version of The Kite Runner?
Yeah, I thought it was a real good partner to the book. I felt in spirit it resembled the book quite
a bit. And A Thousand Splendid Suns is about to become a movie, we think. It's going to be written, the screenplay is written by the guy who wrote Schindler's List and Searching for Bobby Fischer, correct?
Right.
And you are working on a screenplay of your own on a different movie?
Something altogether different on my own. I'm also working on a novel.
Khalid Hosseini, author of The Kite Runner and A Thousand Splendid Suns, our guest this hour on Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins.